This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
Hello and welcome to Eureka Nerd. I am Will, and I've been surviving quarantine mostly with Smash Brothers. Lots of Nintendo. You know, just kind of regressing to my 13-year-old self. I've not changed much in the middle 20 years.
And I'm Leah, and I've been surviving with Animal Crossing and frequent Skype meetings with my colleagues.
Yeah, doing like the actual work thing, which is laudable.
The routine is helping keep me sane. The fact that my colleagues are fantastic and I can actually have a laugh with them really, really helps.
And you're not just saying this because they might listen to this episode?
You know I'm not. You commented the other day after I got off one of my morning meetings. You were like, oh, I wish I could laugh that much with my colleagues.
Instead of arguing, debating, whatever he wants to call it, there's one guy in my office that will pick a fight over everything. But thankfully, I haven't lost one of those fights yet, so, you know, small victories.
Listeners will probably have noticed, if they have, you know, a range of podcasts they consume, that everyone is talking about the virus.
But not us. This is a specifically not coronavirus episode.
How many coronavirus podcasts did you say there were?
Oh, hundreds. Hundreds.
Literally hundreds.
And that's not including the regular news shows that are doing
episodes. Yeah. So we figured you probably know all that you want to know about NCOV-19.
Or that there's people out there who are going to know more and going to have more specific professional insights than we do sat on our sofa. Listen to experts, please.
So we're going to chat about different things. Yay!
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to get this out at the top of the episode rather than leaving it till later. We have gone to Patreon.
We have previously been accepting one-off contributions through Ko-fi. You can carry on doing that. But if you want to make a monthly contribution to offsetting our costs and whatnot, then there is that option now for you.
And you can find that at patreon.com/EurekaNerd, patreon.com/EurekaNerd. If any of you listeners follow us on social media, which hopefully you do, we're on Facebook at /EurekaNerd, we're on Twitter at EurekaNerdcast. The reasons are explained there in full, but a quick summary is it's a strange world out there, a strange time in a strange world, and every little helps. So if you enjoy the show and want to help us keep doing that, come what may, then that really does make a difference, and we thank you tremendously for it.
I really naively thought that I wouldn't have any, like, financial implications from the absolute chaos that's happening. And then.
But you can find more about that in the opening blog post that we've got on patreon.com/EurekaNerd. You don't have to sign up or be a member to read that blog post, but it does explain why we're doing what we're doing and why we're doing it now.
And we are taking suggestions for reward tiers.
If you've always wanted a piece of Eureka Nerd merchandise, a sticker or a badge or a hat with a fan on.
Maybe you just want us to say something in particular for you so that you can set it as your phone ringtone. Or you have a deep desire for some random thing that I've made for no real reason.
Oh yeah, we have lots of crafts around the house. Maybe there should be a tier for if you pitch in X amount, we will send you some crochet.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. You know, maybe you put in some money and I send yarn, maybe?
You can send those ideas to us through any of the social media and also by signing up as a Patreon member and voting in the poll there. Please note, this does not affect any of the work that we're doing with the Stimulus Network. They are all still doing their thing. In fact, the Spooktator just put out an episode that's compelling listening about goblins in Kentucky. It's worth a listen. Please do go check it out.
Damn, I'm going to have to look that up.
In the Petri Dish podcast have done some coronavirus specific content, which you should definitely check out as well.
Yeah, some real quality coronavirus content from inside the Petri Dish.
Mm-hmm. And all the other guys are still doing their stuff too.
Now that we're done advertising, should we...
Yes, now for what you've actually come here for and what you might hopefully continue to pay us for, wink, the science. Starting off with kind of coronavirus adjacent, but maybe not on the top of everyone's mind right now.
Do you know what? Let's stop referencing coronavirus and just pretend this is a normal show now.
Okay, let's see if we can do that. We have a study from Flinders University in Australia looking at Oh no, I'm about to say if I live long enough, but that's coronavirus adjacent as well. I'm sorry.
Hey, I mean, you could die of anything.
I wonder if the listeners at home can hear the smile on your face right now.
Yeah, they definitely can. People can hear it when you smile.
And you're smiling at that. This research from Flinders University looks at something that you might have seen or experienced if you interact or even are a person of a certain age. Once you become what might be termed a middle-aged or older person, you kind of just chill. Just relax into things. You can kind of deal with whatever life throws at you.
I'm really hoping there are a bunch of listeners who have, like, had a full-blown midlife crisis at home who are going, chill? Who's she?
And some people do say that life gets better with age, like wine or not many TV shows. But this research, which is led by Associate Professor Tim Windsor at Flinders University, says that older people have intrinsically built-in well-being practices. You might remember we mentioned well-being practices and research a couple of episodes ago and how some of it is a little woo-ish. But when it comes to just dealing with the stresses that life throws at you, old people have been doing it for a while and they've kind of gotten okay at it.
They specifically mention in the press release that older people are better at employing mindfulness in just experiencing a moment, not judging it, in just being present to experience what's going on, which appears to be a skill they have developed with age, as opposed to one they've specifically brought on. I mean, people love a bit of mindfulness. A lot of people are making a lot of money from mindfulness.
A lot of money.
Because it's not talked about much. I think it's always worth mentioning that mindfulness practices may be actively harmful if you suffer from depersonalization or derealization as part of your mental health situation. That's worth bearing in mind. It's not necessarily the best intervention for everybody. But in this case, it appears that it is the reason older people might generally be happier.
Think of it as being like a rock in a river. Over time, the rock may become weathered, may become displaced, but it is still a rock.
Oh, so you're suggesting actually we really just dig deep and remember no matter what, we are some meat held up by bones.
I mean, we are, but that might not, again, be the most useful thing.
I guess it depends how much trouble you have with, like, abstracting things out to that point. I mean, I find it quite comforting to just be like, I'm just meat on a skeleton. Nothing matters.
Basically a very elaborate corn dog.
Yeah, I quite enjoy leaning into that optimistic nihilism thing. It's a huge universe. I'm a tiny grain of sand. Whatevs. Mm. But that strategy doesn't work for everybody.
These acceptance, non-attachment, and kind of present moment attention things are some of the mindfulness strategies mentioned in the paper. But it seems to be the attitude that once you've reached a certain age, you've seen a lot of stuff and you've been through it, you've made it this far, you can keep going and know that you will survive and continue to be the person that you are. And that's heartening. Older people have had more time to get to that point, so they've internalized it, and they can do it. Good on them.
I mean, we're definitely sort of projecting a lot of things that aren't in this press release, but you get our point, right?
It may take years and years and years and years, but I hope one day I will find my chill as well.
You are literally the chillest person I know.
Oh, that was easy.
That's just one of the reasons I hang out with you, is because you make up for my absolute lack of chill.
Let's continue on with our next story from the University of Washington, talking about social media. Because that's what we need in... I'm sorry, I keep coming back to it. It's coronavirus.
I mean, this one, I think we do have a good point to mention that we're in lockdown because there is a global pandemic and people are spreading all kinds of nonsense through social media, through email and WhatsApp, about the government's going to spray pesticides to kill the virus, and if you can hold your breath for 10 seconds, you don't have coronavirus. So this research from the University of Washington is entirely relevant to that because it's about how people interact with misinformation on Twitter and Facebook.
I think you mentioned there with the helicopters, if listeners could let us know through social media, whoops, what version of that story have you heard? Because there's one going around about them spraying pesticides to kill coronavirus. There's one about them going around spraying the cure to coronavirus. I want to know how this story kind of mutates and spreads.
Yeah, and of those ones that we've encountered. The first one suggests everyone stays indoors while they're doing the spraying. The other one says you must go outside so that you get sprayed. And the way the government in this scenario is communicating it is by a chain letter
to your aunt
through texts,
yeah,
rather than any sort of news coverage, which should tell you that there's something fishy going on.
Mm. Well, when it comes to distrusting the news, there's every good reason to do that for so many places and for so many people in the world. The media landscape is working very hard to engender trust that has been lost after decades of scandals. We trust people that we know implicitly. We trust them so much more because we have this personal connection to them. That actually forms the methodology in this study, that we trust people. What the researchers from the University of Washington done was they got about 25 people to sit down with social media, and they're running a browser extension over their Facebook and Twitter accounts that would overlay news stories that people were sharing with fake news.
And you're probably going, 25 people? That's a very small sample size. This is a pilot study. They cover it in the press release. Good job, University of Washington. The intent is for this study to provide a framework for reactions to misinformation on social media, to use it as a starting point to seek interventions to help people identify and resist misinformation.
So you have the name, the avatar, the icon from a trusted, possibly respectable source coming your way, but the news they are sharing is false. And they were watching to see, do people ignore this? Do they interact? Do they investigate it? What is the reaction to seeing fake news on your timeline? Most of it is ignored, which I guess is a good thing.
Which probably tracks with everyone's personal experiences of using social media, which is you scroll through a lot of posts going, oh, I don't care about their baby. Oh, I don't care what they're doing at work. Oh, that appears to be one of those videos of loads of fake things. And just skip over most of it.
In fact, in the words of Franziska Rosner from the University of Washington, there are a lot of people who try to be good consumers of information, and they're struggling. And if we can understand what they're doing, we might be able to design tools that can help them. Unfortunately, the tool they're using in this experiment is kind of pushing the opposite way, seeing how much they distrust what they interact with. But they were told afterwards, you have been exposed to fake news on this story, and this story. They did clear that up afterwards, which is important, so people aren't just left thinking they've seen the right thing when it's actually wrong.
Yeah, based on my AS level in psychology, they handled this in about the most ethical way they possibly could, and the debrief did involve saying these stories were fake ones, which are browser extension overlaid over your friend's posts, and they are not true. They did collect some qualitative information from their participants by having them sort of talk through their thought processes as they were browsing their feeds.
So people mostly don't react to fake news, which I suppose is something. There is the worry that there's this kind of effective exposure where once you've seen something 5 or 6 times, you just accept it. So there might be a frequency element to it here. They can explore that through later investigations.
And they do mention that possibly even if you've not actively engaged with something, you might passively be absorbing something in the same way as you might with advertising.
There is an interesting thing that some posts do make people skeptical when the person posting it and the post content don't match what you think it should be, if there's a dissonance. Like if you see someone sharing something that you think, oh, maybe this account has been hacked, something that raises any red flags there, then you do interact with it, you might investigate it further and ideally report it as something out of character that you think has been a malicious activity.
I mean, not necessarily even report it, but not share or interact with it in a way that would sort of reinforce that this is something you believe or agree with.
Yeah. Ultimately, the most powerful thing you can do is shut that out. Similarly with advertising, the entire point of advertising through Facebook and Google, which are the two largest advertising platforms in the world, still somehow, despite all of the crimes.
Possibly because of all of the crimes, if we're honest.
They do rely on outrage for clicks, basically. Any interaction still gets them ad money, so they will not care very much. So stay vigilant. Keep your wits about you. If you see something out of character, investigate, but maybe don't participate.
This press release doesn't contain any kind of recommendations from the study because
no, that's just
they
me.
Know it's a starting point.
my advice would be, frankly, turn everything off and go live in the woods.
No, don't go live in the woods. Stay in your home.
If you do not already live in the woods, stay in your home. If you live in your wood home, stay there too.
Your wood home.
Wood home. Treehouse. Shrub hut.
It's like a summer home, but with more leaves.
We've definitely been playing a lot of Animal Crossing.
I'm really enjoying it. I'm having so much fun. Apparently people have been getting the golden tools, and I'm like, how do I get my paws on these?
If you know how to get any of the really good equipment in Animal Crossing, send us a dodo code.
We'll come chat.
Following on from that research from the University of Washington, something from the Society for Personality and Social Psychology, looking this time at not just fake news, but conspiracy theories, kind of the original fake news. And I've done some research into conspiracy theories before. They are a fascinating and dark world to fall into, from like Flat Earth to Avril Lavigne and Andrew WK being conspiracy theories.
The Avril Lavigne one is absolutely wild, but it sort of makes sense. I would maybe argue that the original fake news was like spreading rumours about Janice in the cave down the way, but...
Conspiracy theories today do get somehow a lot of time and attention, even if they are bonkers, especially if they are bonkers, actually.
It feels to me like that is because of the internet. The conspiracy theorists are finding it easier to basically recruit.
Mm. Recruit and amplify their voice, yeah. And convert people, the whole red-pilling thing.
Mm-hmm.
Strange times, strange world. But this research looks at how people engage politically. Now, admittedly, they haven't talked to conspiracy theorists. They have not looked at the voting patterns of conspiracy theorists. What they've done is they have posed a conspiracy multiple choice question.
They gave participants one of three scenarios. So a high conspiracy situation where, please imagine you live in a society where all of everything is controlled by a very small group of powerful people. A medium level where people generally were not totally sure that media and politicians could be trusted, and the low level situation where governments and the media were trustworthy and transparent, which sounds amazing. I'd love to live in that world. And then asked a set of questions to each group of participants to find out what sort of political actions they would take in their given scenario.
And there's the normative actions, like voting, going to rallies, contacting your media or politicians, and the non-normative actions like destroying property, harming others, and what is considered illegal behaviour.
And it did become clear that the groups who had been presented with the more conspiratorial situation were more likely to engage in the non-normative political action and less likely to participate in the normative ones. So essentially, if you're living in a situation where it feels like the structure of society is, you know, falsified, controlled from outside secretly, that kind of thing, you're much less likely to think that voting helps. Which, I mean, you remember in 2016, around the US elections, Tumblr revealed that they'd found there were quite a few very popular blogs which were Russian psyops, yeah. Operations. People have been pointing out again with the primaries going on for the 2020 elections that similar sorts of posts as were being shared by those accounts are turning up on the platform again. And this study is basically looking at what those posts are trying, the effect those posts are trying to have, which is making you feel like the normal ways of engaging with political discourse are ineffective, so don't bother voting. Do something else. And, you know, sometimes you need to have direct action. Sometimes you need to be publicly disruptive. But you do actually need to engage with the political processes that there are as well. So that's my piece. Vote. Especially if you are listening to us in the US. Vote.
Wherever possible, whenever possible, vote.
All the way down the ticket, vote. You can also, you know, do something illegal if it's for the sake of protest.
We're not going to say smash Jeff Bezos's car, but he can afford another one.
Maybe do it as part of like a wider activism so that at least you've got like legal support and things to deal with the consequences of that, because there will be consequences.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than just going off by yourself, be organised.
Yeah, solidarity, community, and action.
Yeah.
Which honestly is going to get you through the current crisis, which we're not going to talk about anymore, solidarity and community in all situations.
It's going to be the thing that helps people survive. We're going to be on a register after this, but
okay. If not already.
If we weren't already, that'd be pretty wild. I've tweeted some things, guys.
I feel like that is a great example of our very next story. You've thrown in a seductive detail that may distract from the overall message.
The seductive detail is, oh my god, what's on her Twitter? Currently, I've been talking an awful lot about how tempted I am to shave my head.
That and Castlevania. And this research comes to us from Washington State University again. Clearly got a very active psychology department.
They're being busy.
Mm. Now, a seductive detail could be something that is interesting but irrelevant. Think of a lot of the things that we tell you. A lot of things that we talk about and share with each other and share with you over this podcast and over social media as well. Apparently, according to this meta-analysis by Washington State University, published in the Journal of Educational Psychology Review, that actually makes it worse for learning.
Sorry.
Whoops.
I'm trying to think of a specific example of when I've been seductive on this podcast, and I'm not sure there is one, but I'm not sure there's not one. I go into the podcast fugue state when we're recording. I don't really remember what I'm saying. I'm just burbling. Mm-hmm. You're the one who edits, so you're probably more likely to think of a time when I've like leant into the mic and when I've flirted with the listeners.
Possible. Probable, even. Listeners, if there's any episode that you can think of where Leah has said something that has made you feel away, then let us know. Send us a message.
Or don't let us know. It might be inappropriate.
Yeah, if it's about like the lobster guts or something.
I mean, if that's what's got people turned on, I don't think that's about me saying it. I think that's about their interesting relationship to crustaceans.
God, when you're talking about those voids in space, it just did something for me.
I bet there are people out there who really enjoyed you talking about the space voids.
I really hope there's a limit to that enjoyment. We're doing it again. We're doing distracting details. Creeper Sundar, lead author on the paper that is based on her dissertation at the College of Education at Washington State University, says, if you have a piece of irrelevant information and it's something that is interesting, students tend to perform worse. Multiple hypotheses on why that happens, but the simplest is that the student's attention is diverted toward irrelevant information and they're spending too much time trying to understand that detail instead of the content matter. So if you throw a joke up alongside something else on the screen, if you put a picture of the Krebs cycle and then a picture of a crab on a bike, that's going to distract people more than trying to memorize all of the different steps of the Krebs cycle, of which there are too many.
I would say that a crab on a bike is a relevant detail to the Krebs cycle because it's going to help you remember it. If you've got the Krebs cycle on one side of your slide and just a completely unrelated cat meme on the other side of the slide, that's when you've got a problem.
Or a single static image just on the screen, just like full-time cat.
Which one's the Krebs cycle? I know I've learned about it. I'm sure it's in my A-level biology notebook in the back room.
Let me try and remember. Vitamin C's in there somewhere.
Vitamin C's in there somewhere? I'm glad that you've had to look it up as well.
Yeah, citric acid cycle.
Okay. What does it do, though?
Generates energy through the oxidation of acetate derived from carbohydrates, fats, and proteins into carbon dioxide.
Okay, that's what I thought it was.
So it's metabolism.
Good, good, good.
Okay.
Good to know. And you, with your structural biology background.
Which I haven't touched in 10 years.
But you do have it tattooed on your arm.
Not that bit of it.
It would be pretty weird to get the Krebs cycle tattooed on you.
It would be impossible to get the Krebs cycle tattooed on me without going over most of my back and chest.
We're doing it again.
We can't stop.
Now that we've mentioned distracting details, we just get distracted. It's terrible. The point is, stay on topic and it will help people learn better. However, Sundar and co-author Olusola Adesope do point out that there may be some trade-offs between the potential emotional development of distracting details that might lessen the anxiety people feel about, for instance, learning maths, and this negative cognitive effect to distracting details, and they are currently investigating the degree to which the hypothesized emotional benefits may compensate for the cognitive disadvantages. So it might be fine.
Maybe they should hire us. Maybe we could tell lots of people distracting information and see what they learn. Either of the authors would like to get in touch with us, they can do that at eurekanerdcast@gmail.com.
And if you'd like to tell us how distracting we are, that's also the place to go.
Also. And then again on Twitter, @EurekaNerdcast, or on Facebook, / EurekaNerd. And if you have found us to be beneficially distracting during these weird, weird times, then please do consider supporting us financially through patreon.com.
Or through Ko-fi for a one-off payment.
So we'll leave with just a few quick messages to distract you, but in like some fun ways. Because who needs to think about anything too seriously right now at all? Please, please don't. No, just don't look. Don't acknowledge it. Don't think about it.
Unless you are literally right now a researcher working on vaccines, in which case do please concentrate on your hard work. We need you.
In the meantime, research from North Carolina State University has failed in its experiment to find out what cats eat in the wild to supplement the food they eat at home, because cat food is too weird and made of different stuff. It's made of all sorts of stuff and they can't figure it out entirely.
I've heard some things about pet food companies, but that's the data right there.
All sorts in cat food. That's the research.
And not even consistent in like one flavour.
All sorts.
All sorts.
And lastly, a tortoise can hold a grudge.
I love the headline of this. A tortoise never forgets. Scientists show tortoises are the elephants of the reptile world.
Greyish, wrinkly-ish.
Some of them are very large.
Some very large, live a long time, definitely hold a grudge. But that's all for now. So until next time, stay at home and goodbye.
Wash your hands. This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.